This is the Medicast, July 16th, 2007. Happy birthday to me.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 75. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you for listening to this podcast. And thank you for checking out the show. If you are a brand new listener to the Medicast, welcome. And I urge you to head on over to medicast.com and check out the website there and the blog and the show notes for this episode and get a handle on some of the other back episodes and get an idea of what the Medicast is all about. And of course, for all of you brand new listeners, thank you for being supporters of the show, for your comments, questions, interests, and just all the contributions that make this community what it is, and I do appreciate that. It's episode 75, a nice round number as we move on towards Big 100, and I am going to be giving away an iPod Shuffle in this episode, so stay tuned. I'll be doing that at the end of the show, and a lucky listener who is a subscriber to the Medicast newsletter will be selected at random, and I will give away a blue iPod Shuffle to that lucky winner, and I'll announce it here, and the way it's going to work is I will basically send out a listener name, and I will also shoot you an email to ask for information back on how to get that iPod Shuffle to you. So stay tuned and check it out. But if you don't get the show right away, you might get an email first from me that'll let you know that you've won. And I just need shipping information so I can get that over to you. Anyway, I want to thank you again for supporting everything and staying tuned. And you can find out more about how you can be a subscriber to the Medicast newsletter a little bit later in this episode. Got a whole bunch of listener email this week, and I want to get through that right away, so let's get started. First, I got an email from listener Benji, and he was asking a couple of different things. First of all, he wanted to know about getting his email newsletter address changed. And just to let you all know, that email system that I use for the newsletter is completely automated. It's one of the things that helps me comply with spam regulations in the United States and make sure that you actually have to opt in to be a member of the newsletter. You fill out the web form and then you must click on a response link in an email that is sent to you. And this protects you from having somebody else sign you up for some newsletter so you're getting spammed to death. And so if you want to change any of your information in your email newsletter subscription, you just click on the link. There's a link to update your options or unsubscribe all at the bottom of each email I send out for that newsletter. And you can click on that and go through the process of unsubscribing, changing your email address, changing your vital information that you may have entered. Like if you've upgraded your certification from an EMTB to an EMTI or an EMTP, you can do all of that at the newsletter subscription site there, but you have to click the link in the email that you receive. That is your unique identifier, and I don't have any control over that. The only thing I'm allowed to do is actually is I can unsubscribe you directly, but I can't subscribe you, and I can't change any of your personal information. So, Benji, thanks for sending that in. He also asked about some information on EMTT or tactical medics, and if anybody has any information on EMTTs or is an EMTT and would be interested in maybe letting me conduct a quick phone interview on tactical EMS, I would be greatly appreciative, and I think the listeners would too. So give me an email here at podmedic@mac.com or call me on the voicemail line and touch base with me, and then maybe we can set up an interview time and talk a little bit about this area. I don't know a whole lot about tactical EMS other than the fact that it exists and they have a little bit more basis in trauma skills. So anyway, I just think that that would be a great subject to cover, and I do appreciate Benji sending in that suggestion. I next got an email from listener James, and he's an EMTB in a rural EMS service and is really excited about listening to the show, like shows like the Medicast, like Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal, and also soaking up all of the information that he can find to further his education. He would like to eventually advance beyond his EMTB certification and move into ALS skills, and is actively pursuing the basis for that by educating himself about EMS beyond his own skill level. And he's running into some problems. He's running into some issues where people are giving him grief about increasing his certification level, and people who at the ALS level seem to be reluctant to share information about what they're doing, why they're doing it, and seem to get annoyed with him because he's so enthusiastic about learning. And this is a problem that I think a lot of us that are striving to increase our skill set and continue our education actively run into. I ran into this when I was an EMTB, James, and so I can sympathize with you a little bit. You know, when I was an EMTB, I was always reading and always doing a lot of work to educate myself and ask a lot of questions. And some of the people around my own company began to call me Paramedic Jamie, even though I wasn't a paramedic yet, and they kind of meant it as a slur. And you know what? I took it to be a truth and took it to be a compliment. And, you know, it stopped very quickly when I signed up for paramedic class and when I used my advanced knowledge that I had gained by reading and educating myself to be the top person in my class. So I think that, James, you're on the right track, and people around you are going to be threatened by your drive to be more. And that's normal in any field and in any endeavor you may encounter in life. Whenever somebody tries to stick their neck out and get above the crowd, there are always going to be people around you, people that you may consider good friends, who by reflex almost will try to, you know, keep your feet on the ground, you know, want you to be realistic. And, you know, realism is okay in some respects, but when you're looking at your dreams and aspirations, you need to be a little unrealistic, and as far as the view of everyone else is concerned, at least. So I urge you to continue your education, continue asking questions, and as far as ALS providers that are reluctant to share information with you, well, I have very little patience with that kind of thing. I think that a well-educated EMTB who at least understands the basic concepts of ALS care makes me a better provider, because they become a more skilled extra pair of hands to assist me when I'm performing interventions. You know, when you need something in a hurry and you've got an EMTB who's thinking along with you and is one step ahead of you in some respects to think about what you might need next, that is going to be a life-saving skill in and of itself. So you're going to find some people that are going to try to hold you back, but I urge you to continue on and you be the best EMTB you can be and strive to move on and be the best medical provider at whatever skill level you arrive at in the end, because that's ultimately what we should all be doing. And thanks for your email. I got another email from listener Janet, who is going to be a junior in high school and is really goal-oriented on becoming a paramedic slash firefighter. She's been listening to the podcast for some time and has been catching up on back episodes, and she is interested in what she can do to continue furthering her education while she's still in high school. Janet, that's going to really depend on the protocols and age requirements for EMS in your particular jurisdiction, in your county or state. And that's something you can probably best find out by checking with existing EMTs. Maybe if you have a local volunteer service nearby, you can find out about how old you have to become a cadet in their program or a probationary member or whatever they might call members that are under the age of 18. Different services have different requirements. In the state of Maryland, you have to be at least 16 to start your EMT training, and so you can become an EMT by the time you're about 16 and a half, almost 17. However, there are local restrictions by county that restrict how old you can be to provide on your own. You can use your skills, but you may have to ride with a preceptor until you're 18. And that's in this area, at least. But you'll need to find out basically that on your own. And I would contact your local fire company. I would contact your local volunteer service and talk to your guidance counselor in your high school. Have them do some research for you and find out exactly what the age requirements are in your state. That way you'll be prepared and can plan for your education. If your ultimate goal is to be a paramedic and you need to be 21 to get that paramedic certification, well, I urge you to go ahead and work on a four-year degree and get your paramedic along the way. There's some great institutions out there that offer a four-year EMS program that includes a basis in management and also a stronger background in your anatomy, physiology, and medical knowledge. So all of this can help you become a better paramedic and give you a different option set in your career choices as you move on into the career as a firefighter and paramedic. So I hope that helps out, Janet, and I hope it helps out the other listeners, and thank you very much for your question. And finally here, I got an email from listener Scott, who is a paramedic with 7 years experience in Santa Clara County, California, and he has recently noticed some new street drug information that he thought he'd share with the listeners. And what he's finding is that these teenagers are drinking a concoction that is being called Ocean. Ocean is basically the remnants of what is left in the can when you drain the liquid out of hairspray. It's a variety of wood alcohol. It's then mixed with fruit juice and is distributed for drinking. And of course is causing a lot of issues because, of course, methanol or wood alcohol is extremely toxic and is not easily metabolized by the body. So guess what, Scott? You've given me a great idea to cover for this week's Med of the Week. So I'll be covering a little bit more about this particular problem and reactions to this drug overdose in the Med of the Week a little later in this episode. And Scott, thank you for this suggestion. All of these suggestions, whether it's for a tip or trick or for a Med of the Week, really do a lot to help me keep the show moving on and keep it interesting for the listeners. The link of the week this week comes to us by way of a listener who sent me a link to a site called Rescuing Providence. It's an EMS blog put out there by an EMS provider from Providence, Rhode Island. And he writes a blog about his efforts and that the efforts of his coworkers in Providence, Rhode Island, dealing with providers and patients and all of the other issues we focus on. And it's a great blog. There's a lot of great information there and a lot of sharing of stories, which I think is important for us to do because, you know, we all can run into something that no one else has ever seen before. And how we handle the issues we run into, whether it's because we made a mistake or because we made the right choice, all of these things help us to not make the mistake that someone else made or to remember to make the right choice that someone else made in the future. And it's important to share that information. I urge you to head on over and check it out. Again, it's at rescuing-providence.blogspot.com. And there will be a link in the show notes. So head on over and check out Rescuing Providence. Okay, I guess that means it's time to move on into this week's news. You know, I had a nice long chat with our friend Chris Black while he was helping me out with the Medicast Live this past week, and he and I have had an ongoing discussion by email and by Skype phone call discussing the purported shortage of paramedics. And Chris has an interesting take on this. He thinks we should have fewer EMT schools and fewer paramedic schools so that we turn out a higher quality of paramedic and EMT rather than just turning people out in bulk. And yet I come across stories like the story I'm going to lead off with tonight, where there is a report of a drastic paramedic shortage in Kentucky and other parts across this country, and I suspect around the world. Paramedics are not available to fill vacant positions, and they are really striving to get the job done by working people extra overtime and really running the providers they have into the ground. And we all know, whether you're a volunteer or a paid provider, that retention is a huge problem in our field, that we have people that just get so burned out because they're run so hard and they don't get paid a lot for their work, and we're short paramedics. Well, you know, if we made the pay a little bit better, that would help. And we need to do more to provide scholarship, to provide high-quality programs. So I agree with Chris in that respect, to turn out good EMS providers at all levels around the country. And this is going to be a problem everywhere. The article I have, you can check out a link in the show notes, talks about the problems in central Kentucky. But these problems are everywhere. They're present here in Maryland. They're present in California. They're present all over the United States. And I suspect also around the world. And they're just going to be issues with this until several things get solved, both the pay grade issue as well as the cost of the education. So we'll have to look into that more as time moves on. The next item I found in the news, I think, is a great article that points at the value of having well-educated and dedicated paramedics working for your service in the field. It has to do with the safe surrender laws that are cropping up around the country right now. That has to do with the, I guess, proper way, if you have a baby that you don't want to keep, that is there a way you can abandon your child in such a way as to keep the child safe and not incur any penalties yourself? It used to be a crime to have a baby and then not want to have it and not want to keep it and have to go through all the rigmarole of adoption and signing up. And, you know, if it's something you want to hide, there's not an easy way, or hasn't been an easy way, to hide the fact that you've had a baby. And this is an issue when you have no other recourse, but or at least think you have no other recourse than to leave your baby in a dumpster or behind a building in an alleyway. And I'm not condoning that. I'm just trying to understand a difficult situation. Sometimes people make poor choices. We see it all the time. And so a paramedic from North Carolina has come up with a series of signs that he has created that will be posted on paramedic and fire stations and other locations around his region in an effort to educate people that those locations are what are considered safe surrender locations. That in their state, infants up to 7 days old may be left with any responsible adult, preferably at a hospital, police, or fire station, without any fear of punishment or retaliation. And between the years of 2001 and 2005, at least 5 women took advantage of the law. But recently, in the area that this paramedic is from, several newborns have been found dead in dumpsters and in inappropriate locations. And he believes it's because there is a lack of education. You know, the people that are doing this, that are making these decisions, quite often are the most poorly educated in our communities and lack the resources to know about some of the services that are available to them. So by educating in the schools, by educating in the community, and by making signs clearly available and driving publicity about what those signs mean, he hopes to create a better knowledge zone so that people are aware that this law exists, that you won't get in trouble, that you can leave your baby with these trained professionals and you will not be found guilty or charged with a crime or get in trouble for doing so. So I think this is a great program, and it just shows the initiative that dedicated paramedics can take and the services that we provide to our community outside the services that we are initially trained to provide. The next item in the news has to do with strokes, stroke centers, and advice that patients receive in the field. And we've talked about strokes quite a bit here. We did a Medicast Live on stroke care and stroke centers a few months ago. And we've talked about strokes as a tip of the week in the past here at the Medicast. And so it bothers me very much when, despite all of the information that is out there about stroke care, that the operators that are answering the phones at hospitals and on health lines are apparently uneducated in how to give patients good advice about strokes. In fact, according to a recent study, 1 in 4 patients who call health lines and hospital lines about classic symptoms of stroke are not told to call 911. That means 25% of the potential stroke patients out there that call into these services are not getting rapid advanced care that they need. And this is coming from a researcher at a stroke facility that found out that many of the patients that come to their facility are coming in more than 3 hours after their symptom onset, many as often as days later. And of course, this is well outside the window that is necessary to give thrombolytics and break up the clots that are causing the stroke. And so we need to really do more to educate the public. And we need to do more to educate our professionals. Now, this isn't talking about 911 operators. Our dispatchers have a different training set. But this is talking about operators at hospital switchboards and operators that operate so-called health lines, where they use a computer access system to type in information the patient is requesting and giving back the information that they may need. So again, we need to kind of check out these things and find out what services are available in our communities, and then maybe double check and make sure those services are giving out the information that they need to do. Finally, for our last news story, I thought I'd touch a little bit on summertime issues in EMS. And I found an article from a few weeks ago that had to do with a problem at the U.S. Women's Open back at the end of June. And they were saying that dehydration and heat stroke caused 3 or 4 people on one day to pass out at the Open and were treated for various degrees of heat emergency. And this is a problem we run into quite frequently, especially as people like to gather for public festivals and events in the summertime. And of course, in those situations often involve alcohol, and people just aren't getting hydrated as they need to. And this is a problem. And I think I'll probably cover something about heat emergencies each year during this season, because I think it's something that we need to re-educate ourselves on frequently. And so, thanks to this news article, I think I'll jump right on into this week's tip and trick of the week. Heat emergencies can be classified into 3 groups, and they're increasing in level of severity, starting with heat cramps, which is caused by muscle cramping from the loss of salt from heavy sweating. This can then lead to heat exhaustion, which is caused by increased dehydration, and eventually this can all progress to heat stroke, which can cause profound shock symptoms as well as long-term issues like brain damage, organ failure, and death. And indeed, this is one of the leading causes of death in athletes that begin training for fall athletic sports in the end of the summertime, both college, high school, and professional athletes. So we have our people who are supposedly in the best shape of any of us, but they do not follow some basic rules and can quickly become dehydrated and lead to eventually death if it's not caught fast enough. So what are we looking for when we look for patients that have symptoms of heat emergencies? Well, first of all, some of the basic causes of heat emergencies. We've talked about them and leading up to this point, but let's really codify them and get them down. Of course, high temperatures, but also high humidity. So a relatively lower temperature with a higher humidity can be something that leads to heat exhaustion, heat stroke, just as fast as a higher temperature and no humidity. Also, dehydration, prolonged or excessive exercise, wearing excessive clothing, alcohol use, also the use of certain medications like diuretics, anticholinergics, neuroleptics, phenothiazines, all of these can contribute to dehydration of the body and contribute to a depression of the body's response mechanisms. And of course, cardiovascular disease and people with dysfunction of their sweat glands. Symptoms we're going to be looking for, at least in early symptoms to begin with, profuse sweating, fatigue, thirst, and muscle cramps. And this is the people in the early stages where they're starting to get the cramping. They're becoming dehydrated. They're losing salts that their muscle and body need to metabolize effectively. And they're still sweating. And this is a key sign. When you see someone that's still sweating that is starting to show signs of a heat emergency, you really got it in the earlier stages and you can make a big difference by taking some initial actions. Later symptoms of heat exhaustion include headache, dizziness, lightheadedness, weakness, nausea and vomiting, cool, moist skin, and dark urine. So again, the body's beginning to show shock symptoms here. Cool, moist skin, nausea, vomiting, weakness, dizziness, altered mental status, all of these things showing problems. Noticing dark urine is a sign that they're becoming dehydrated. The urine's becoming concentrated as the body tries to conserve fluids. Eventually, heat stroke will set in if not treated or intervened for, and that includes fever with temperatures of the body above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, irrational behavior, extreme confusion, dry, hot, red skin. Again, notice dry. The body has now become dehydrated to the point that it can no longer use its defense mechanisms to cool the body off, and that is a very dangerous sign. That means that the body is no longer compensating and is actually trapping heat inside and around the internal organs. You also see rapid shallow breathing, rapid weak pulses, seizures, and unconsciousness. Again, signs of advanced shock. So what are we going to do here? The first thing we need to do is get the person out of the hot environment, if at all possible. This is why, at least in the United States, all ambulances are required to have some kind of a environmental control system, an air conditioner, a heater. So in the wintertime, we can warm the patient up, and in the summertime, we can put that air on and cool the patient down. We want to get layers of clothing off of them. You'll find this most often in our homeless population. These are people who literally carry all their possessions with them around, whatever they own, on their backs. And the easiest way to carry extra clothing that you're going to need when it gets cold again is to wear that coat or wear that extra layer of shirts. And this is what's going to cause dehydration and heat emergencies in these patients very rapidly. So we need to get the layers of clothing off of these people. Get them in a cool, dry place. If you're seeing signs of shock, you can initially put them in Trendelenburg position. Get their feet elevated and give them an opportunity to try to replace some of that blood flow. Again, the extremities are going to be relatively cooler than the rest of the body, so you can do this and shunt some of the cooler blood to the rest core of the body, at least get started. You're going to need to follow your own protocols on how you're going to be appropriately cooling this person down. Some places want you to do it more rapidly than others, but some of the things you can do is maybe apply a cool, damp cloth to the forehead, to the back of the neck. You can also place cold compresses in the groin or the armpits. These are places with good vascular access, and you'll be able to cool the blood down in those locations. You want to make sure if you're using ice packs that you wrap them so that they do not come in direct contact with the skin, because you can cause local hypothermia or cold injuries if you're not careful. If the person is alert, certainly hydrate them by giving them beverages, something like a Gatorade or a salted drink. You can use a basic salt sugar solution by mixing a teaspoon of salt per quart of water. You can also add sugar to that as well if you think that they're profoundly dehydrated. And you can give them a half cup of this to drink about every 15 minutes if necessary. Cool water will do just fine. The body can do without the salts, but it definitely needs the water, at least in the short term. Again, if they're showing signs of shock or if they have altered mental status and you have the capability to do so, IV access is always warranted here. High flow IVs, maybe a second IV line in place as well. Let's get a liter of fluid into this person rapidly. We can get their blood volume up. We can cool them off by giving them room temperature fluids. Hang that IV bag in front of your air conditioner vent and cool it a little bit. You're going to need to be careful with this. You want to really monitor the patients. You certainly don't want to send them in the opposite direction and make them hypothermic. This causes a whole other set of symptoms. So monitor their temperature as best you can and be prepared to cover them up and keep them at an even temperature once you seem to see signs of improvement. It's important, though, to not underestimate the problems that you find with heat-related illnesses. People can deteriorate very rapidly, and one of the things you want to look for is, do they seem like they're sweating, and have they stopped sweating? Ask a bystander, have they been sweating at all? Well, they were sweating a lot 5 minutes ago, but you know, they're not so much now, so I think they're feeling better. Well, if they're not looking better, and this is what they tell you, that may be an indication that they've progressed into a more severe stage. You also want to make sure that they're alert. Don't give them directly salt tablets. Give them liquids, not liquids containing things like alcohol or caffeine. Again, alcohol is a central nervous system depressant, and it inhibits the body's ability to compensate for things like dehydration and heat. So this is why we see this problem at festival-type events, because people are not adequately hydrating themselves, and I'm sorry to say this, beer doesn't count. This is just a basic cover of heat emergencies. Again, you want to check your own protocol. This is a good time to review those kind of things, find out exactly what your system allows, and maybe the next time you're in with an ER doc, you know, ask them the question, what are you seeing in heat emergencies coming in? What are you guys looking to do or want us to do in the field? Maybe you'll get your local ER physician or medical director to give you some pointers on what they would like to see you do when you're bringing a patient into them. Again, education is important. Make sure you get out there and educate the public about what to do. I'll have a post up later in this week about some information that you can give out, both for yourself, your family, your coworkers, and of course to the public at large, about avoiding problems with heat emergencies. Well, it's time to jump into this week's Med of the Week. And I again want to thank the listener earlier that sent me this tip. I really appreciate it when you guys give me ideas. And if you've sent me a tip in and you haven't heard back from me, don't be afraid after a few months to send it in again. Sometimes I put stuff in the inbox and try to save it and keep it on the back burner because I already have ideas for the upcoming episodes, but I want to use it. And what happens is it gets so far down in my email that eventually it just gets lost. Sometimes I try to go back and look at those things, but if you really want to hear about something and after a few months you haven't heard it or haven't gotten a response from me, don't hesitate to send it in again. You're not bothering me. I love to hear from you guys, and it gives me an opportunity to keep the show on track, and reminders are always helpful. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about methanol, which is also known as wood alcohol. And unlike ethanol, which is grain alcohol, methanol is extremely toxic to the human body. We are only able to partially metabolize it, and one of the side products, byproducts of metabolizing wood alcohol is we actually create formaldehyde and eventually break that down into formic acid. And this is why you hear about people going blind from drinking alcohol. It actually is a result of drinking wood alcohol in most instances, and it's because of this acidotic response to the deconstruction or metabolizing of methanol in the body. And we create problems like optic nerve degeneration from the formic acid. So we need to find ways to look for this problem, to learn about it, and then to treat it. So let's look about where, first of all, we can find wood alcohol. Wood alcohol is present in many household items. things we find commonly in our life. And this is why this may be a problem we run into with young children, especially, as well as pets, because it is found in things like antifreeze, canned heating sources, copy machine fluids, de-icers, fuel additives, paint remover or thinner, shellac varnishes, windshield wiper fluid, and as the listener pointed out, also as a carrier mechanism for things like hairspray and other aerosolized consumer products. And since people are always looking for a cheaper, easier way to get high, these products can be bought for, you know, a dollar, a couple dollars, and it's not regulated, and they can go out and drain off the fluid in the can and think they're getting away with something. And all they're getting away with is a trip to the hospital at best. Methanol poisoning will affect GI tract, the nervous system, and also, as I said earlier, the ophthalmological symptoms, systems like the optic nerve, which degenerates in the presence of the formic acid that is created. Symptoms that you may find are very similar to symptoms of standard alcohol abuse, and these include agitation, dizziness, headache, coma, seizures. You may also find problems like blindness, blurred vision, dilation of the pupils. You may also have abdominal pain, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting. Now, this all sounds very much like regular alcohol poisoning. You have breathing difficulty, decreased respirations, fatigue, cramps, decreased blood pressure, general weakness. All of these things may be present in patients that you encounter. And so how do you find out if they've been using wood alcohol versus grain alcohol? Well, again, this is where your technique for getting a good history comes in. Use your eyes, use your ears, and use your mouth. Look around the scene. If there are hairspray cans sitting out on the counter in the living room, well, maybe that's an indication that these products wouldn't ordinarily be left out in that setting. And maybe that's what they've been using. Look for signs that a child has gotten under the kitchen sink or into the medicine cabinet, or maybe was left alone in the garage or the shed and found these products. You want to then listen. Maybe the friends of the patient aren't really willing to share information. The police are standing around because it came in as an overdose, and yet you hear them whispering off in the corner. This is the time when you send your partner, or maybe you go yourself and ask them to come into another room where you can be alone and just say, look, I need to know, okay, what were you guys taking? It doesn't go beyond me, but I need to know how to help your friend, and I can't tell the doctor what's going on unless you tell me. And you need to develop a rapport very quickly with people. You say, you know, I'm wearing a uniform, but I am not a police officer. I'm here only to help treat your friend and keep them alive. And you just need to tell me what's going on. And you can do the same thing with the patient themselves. I always tend to wait till I get in the back of the ambulance if the patient is conscious and we have a lot of people around, especially family members or law enforcement officers. Let the patient get alone in the back with you and then stop and say, look, not the cops. Tell me what's going on. This is how you build a rapport, and you need to kind of come upon that yourself. But that's going to be important, because when you get a good history, it's going to affect how we treat this patient, because there are some things we can do to treat the patient with this kind of poisoning. Patients with this kind of situation in place are going to start off with our standard BLS or ALS interventions, depending on your level of care. Good vital signs, observe the patient. You want to make sure you're maintaining an open airway. You're going to be prepared to maybe bag this patient, or if you're an ALS provider, intubate this patient. You're also going to want to get IVs established. You know, it's the old O2 IV monitor mantra. All these things are vital in this patient. You want to do what you can to provide supportive care. Definitive care for this patient, at least in the field, is not really available unless you have a certain kind of drug in your kit, which I don't think a lot of us have. I've been burned on that before, but if you do have some of these meds, you may be able to use them. Because acidosis is induced, bicarbonate is an option. You can give them sodium bicarb, but again, you're going to want to consult with medical control. If you do have a good history, if you know they've ingested wood alcohol, I would definitely call medical control and see if they want you to go ahead and administer bicarb. But remember, we don't give bicarb unless you've got strong airway and ventilatory management available or in place, because there's going to be no way for them to blow off that CO2 if you don't get that airway secured so that they can do that. So bicarb is going to be one of those things you're going to want to keep in the back of your bag of tricks. But it's there for treatment of this medication overdose. At the hospital, they're going to need dialysis because of the liver function issues that are brought about very quickly. Again, they could have long-term optic nerve problems, and the only way to treat that is to get some of these antidotes and dialysis treatments in place rapidly. So rapid transport and care of this patient is indicated. Reversing the effects of the poison, there are drugs that can be given. There's a drug called fomepizole, F-O-M-E-P-I-Z-O-L-E. There's information on that in the show notes link, so go ahead and check that out. And also, strangely enough, ethanol. There is a treatment program in place now in a lot of places where they're actually giving IV ethanol to patients of wood alcohol overdose. And the reason for that is that the ethanol is a more active binding site for the metabolite enzymes that deal with wood alcohol. So if you can get ethanol into the patient's system, it will actually compete successfully for the metabolism enzymes needed to break down the wood alcohol as well, and therefore slowing down the production of the formaldehyde and formic acid. And so that's been a seemingly successful treatment. And I have a link in the show notes to a study that you can download and read on the effectiveness of ethanol administration. And I don't know if this is going to be something we're necessarily going to do in the field, although interestingly enough, before the IV study, apparently oral ethanol administration was indicated in some cases. And some places, hospitals and medical services were actually using over-the-counter whiskey, basically your standard run-of-the-mill liquor store whiskey, to treat this product in an oral administration. You're also going to want to contact poison control, just like any overdose and poisoning, and your local medical control. And in addition to the administration of bicarb, IV access, O2, ventilatory management, and everything else, charcoal may be also indicated in this patient. When they get to the hospital, again, dialysis, ethanol administration, the fomepizole administration, and also gastric lavage, NG tube placement, all of these things are probably going to be standard procedure once they get to the emergency department. So this is a good look at wood alcohol. And again, I want to thank you guys when you send in tips like this, because this is not a topic I had really looked at in depth. And I gained a lot of education from looking into this, and I hope you all will as well. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast. And I guess it'll bring us into the time of the show where some of you have been waiting with bated breath to find out who is the lucky winner of the iPod Shuffle. The iPod Shuffle, again, is a blue iPod Shuffle that I'll be giving away. You will get it by mail as soon as I get a response from you with your current address or shipping location so I can get it off to you. And I will be finding this by gathering the number of people on my email list and then submitting that to a random number generator, which will give me a random number, and I will then select that lucky winner. So let's go ahead and do that right now. And the lucky winner of the iPod Shuffle I'm giving away for the 75th anniversary show is listener Josh. And Josh, I'll be sending you an email to request information. I want to thank all of you for being subscribers to the email newsletter. If you aren't already a subscriber to the email newsletter, basically, it's a way for you to get all of the show notes links sent directly to your email address each week. And I don't share that information with anybody. It is strictly for the use of myself here at the Medicast as a way to get information out to the listeners in an efficient fashion and share important things that come up with you. You cannot expect anything more than maybe 5, at top 6 emails a month from me. That means an email for each episode that's published, as well as perhaps another email when there's special events or things going on that I think you should know about. So again, this is not a spam list, and I don't share this with anybody. And you can sign up for that over at the website at medicast.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a link to sign up for the free Medicast newsletter. Click that link, fill out the information, send it in, and you'll get an email back that'll ask you to click a link to verify, and then you'll be all signed up. So I thank you all for being subscribers to the show, being subscribers to the newsletter, and for everything you've done to help make the Medicast what it is. I greatly appreciate it. The response to this show over the last year and a half has been heartwarming. I began this show as an effort to educate myself and also provide a service that I just wasn't finding out there in the blogosphere and on the podcast networks. And that was a way for EMTs and paramedics to get information brought to them here and there in ways that they can continue their education and be more informed providers in the field. And based on your comments and the information I've gotten back from you, the listeners, I think I've at least in part reached that goal. And so I guess, you know, here it is, my birthday, and I have to say the best birthday present I could get from you all is the fact that you're happy with the show and that it's providing you the services that you all need. And that's the thanks enough for doing what I'm doing, really, in so many ways. I'm looking and working hard at expanding the show and getting more information available to you. And as those things come online, I will be making them available and letting you all know about that. But I just have to give you my sincere thanks for all of the support that you've all given to the show. If you do want to contact me here at the show, you can do so at podmedic@mac.com and catch up with me by email. And you can also reach me directly using the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That is 941-30-MEDIC. You can call in, leave a message for me. If you want, leave your email address at the very end, and that will give me an opportunity to get back to you if I have any questions or want to expand the comment that you've made and give me more information to respond to you. And don't worry, I'll clip it off so that your email address stays only with me. So you can get your voicemail comment here heard live on the Medicast by calling into the voicemail line. I'm going to wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. This week will be from a listener's band, and this is another way you can support the show. If you have a band or you know of a band in your community that writes original music that would like to share their music with other listeners, you can put me in touch with them directly, and I would be happy to play their music. They can shoot me a CD or send me a file, and I can listen to it and share it with the rest of you. So this is a great way to do that, and listener Zach has been a contributor to the show in the past from his band In Caves. And Zach, I know you're out there listening, so I want to thank you for being a supporter of the show, and I'm going to play one of your songs again. This is a repeat song. I've played it in the past. It's a great tune by this band. You can check out a link to their website in the show notes or head on over to incaves.com. And I'm going to be playing their song Silver Lining because, you know, no matter how bad things get out there, if we look hard enough, we can always find a silver lining to what's going on in our lives. So until next week with the next great episode here of the Medicast, I'd like to thank you all for listening. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene Safety, BSI.